Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
Welcome to a very special edition of Transatlantic Express Radio Show here on the House of Prog and on CJSF. Today is special because we get to interview the legendary guitar player, singer, composer, artist, Mr. Bill Nelson. Bill Nelson is from Yorkshire in England, and he spoke with us earlier this week. We are going to play some of his songs, and going to play some old songs, some new songs, and get into it. We're going to start off with this one. It's called Shine. It's from Live in the Air Age with Beatbox Deluxe. Enjoy the interview, and we'll see you on the other side.
Hello, is this Bill?
It is, yeah.
Bill, it's Ian Gregson calling from Vancouver.
Oh, hi, Ian.
How you doing?
Not too bad, thank you.
Not too bad, good. Listen, I won't keep you too long on the phone. Maybe about half an hour, is that okay?
That'll be fine, yeah.
Thanks for doing this interview. It's been a long time goal of mine to contact you and have a chat. Just a little bit of a background. I have a radio show on thehouseofprog.com. I'm originally from the Wigan area.
Okay.
I've been here 40 years, but I play a lot of old British stuff, new stuff, anything from like the New Cure album right back to recently played the whole of your Northern Dream album on my show.
Wow. So
going back a few years, but I play a lot of old stuff and I try and play as much new stuff. There's a lot of good music out there these days, so I wanted to have a chat with you. So you're joining the ranks of people like Gary Moore and Alan Holdsworth, who I've interviewed over the years as well. So we try and keep it civil and just very casual and just have a good chat, basically.
Okay.
Is that all right?
That's fine, yeah.
So basically, what we could start with maybe is that we... let's start. I know going back to early days, I'm a musician, I play guitar, I've followed your music for many years since I was a kid living in England. Maybe we can start with like how you started in, I think it was Wakefield. And just kind of give us kind of a fairly, you know, concise perspective of where you started and where you are now and how much that has changed. Because to me, you started off as very much a DIY guy, and that's where you are now. You do a lot of your own material. You play, when you do play live, you play, you know, just as with yourself, that I've seen. Maybe just give us a kind of how things have changed for you in that process.
Okay, well, I mean, when I don't know whether this is what you mean, but when I first started to play guitar, I was 10 or 11 years old, and what kicked that off basically was that I heard a record on the radio by Duane Eddy, the American guitarist, and it was called Because They're Young, and I just loved the sound of the guitar. So I started out by making copies of Duane Eddy's guitar by cutting them out of cardboard. Not that they would play, but they looked good when you stood in front of the mirror. So and then eventually my dad got me a second-hand Archtop acoustic guitar, and I started from there, and then eventually after a year or two he bought me a solid body electric guitar, and I met a friend at school who was about at the same stage of learning as I was, and we started a little school band. And it all went on from there, bit by bit. I was influenced in the early days by Duane Eddy, The Shadows, The Ventures. Then I got into Chet Atkins, and then into jazz. People like Wes Montgomery, Kenny Burrell, Jim Hall, Joe Pass. So it went on through there to... when the psychedelic era started, I had a three-piece sort of psychedelic blues rock band called Global Village. Before that, I was playing in local bands that played around the whole area of Yorkshire, playing in pubs and working men's clubs, doing covers. So we covered whatever was in the charts. We did old standards. So it was a basic grounding in all kinds of forms of music. And then eventually I did Northern Dream, which was done in a home studio. A local guy had a home studio called Holy Ground. And we did the Northern Dream album. That's the first batch of songs I'd written. John Peel heard that, or got hold of a copy of that somehow, and played it on his radio program, played the entire album. And the next thing I knew, EMI got in touch and wanted to sign me to a record deal. But they wanted me to re-record Northern Dream with session musicians. But I wasn't interested in doing that because at this point in time I'd just formed Bebop Deluxe. And I think we were a couple of weeks old, that's all. And I took a tape down we'd made of a couple of songs to EMI, and I said, no, you know, this is what I'm doing now, have a listen to this. And they said, well, you've only been together 2 weeks, so let's give it a few months and we'll come and see you play. And they came up to see us play in Leeds, but weren't happy with the band, but they still offered me a solo deal. And I sort of stuck up for the band and said, no, it's the band or nothing. And this went on for a couple of months or so, and then eventually we landed a gig at the Marquee Club in London, and the A&R guy from EMI came along and to see how we would go down with a London audience, and as it happened we went down really well. So he came backstage at the Marquee and said, okay, come into EMI's headquarters tomorrow, we'll talk about a deal for the band. So that's how the professional career started at that point, once we got the deal.
And how times have changed since then, though.
You
were literally, you know, some kid from Yorkshire going down to London. I mean, that doesn't happen anymore, does it? I mean, it's you gotta put yourself out on the internet these days and deal with that. But as a record collector, the history of Harvest and Derham and Phonogram with Vertigo has always been a big history, because that period from like 70 to about, I don't know, about 70, late 70s, they were all in battle with each other to get who could get. I think Vertigo were just signing people left, right, and center. The guy who ran it from Denmark just had a limitless budget to sign whoever he wanted. You were part of that wave, being on Harvest, even though it had a fairly conservative EMI company, but they gave you some pretty free range to do what you wanted.
Yeah, well, the guy who was in charge of Bebop Deluxe at Harvest was a chap called Nick Mumps. And Nick was just a huge music enthusiast. He didn't think in an accountant's way at all about things. And when he signed us, he said, look, I'm not looking to get a hit on the first album. We'll be looking for something like that about the third album. But we want to nurture you and help you to get, you know, where you need to go. And it was like that. It was really supportive. Eventually EMI got taken over by another company. This is in the very late 70s, early 80s. We got taken over by Thorn Lighting Industries, and the whole system of signing bands and so on then changed. It became more run by the accountants than by the A&R people. And I had a band called Red Noise at that point, after Bebop. And
they were on Harvest still.
Yeah. But after that first album, when the, which was when about the takeover of EMI happened, the policies changed and we got dropped, as did several other more left field bands such as Wire and so on. So that's how I came to start my own record label at that point, because you know, it was the only way I could see to get stuff out there. And I'd recorded an album called Quit Dreaming and Get on the Beam for EMI, which hadn't been released at that point, but the recording was just finished. And they didn't release it, and they sat on it basically for, I think, 2 years. And then Phonogram, a guy called David Bates, who was an A&R man at Phonogram, asked me, "What are you doing these days?" I said, "Well, I've done an album for EMI, but they're not releasing it." And he said, "I'd like to hear it." So I had a tape copy of it, and I gave him a cassette tape of it. And he said, "Well, we'll put it out." So then they bought Quit Dreaming and Get on the Beam from EMI and released it on, I forgot the name of the label now, Mercury.
Right.
Which was an offshoot from the Gamblers and the Mercury.
I think it was released on Portrait here, over here. I
it was maybe in America, yeah.
Yeah, I have, yeah. I have the Canadian copy of it. Portrait.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was, you know, it was good to get it out there, even though it was a couple of years late. But it went into the top 10 in the UK. And that was a vindication, you know. You might drop that album, but it went top 10 when it did come out, so I felt vindicated by that.
Mm-hmm. So maybe let's talk about where you are today. You've released a lot of material over the last, say, 20 years. Maybe as a person who I do a lot of recording here at my home studio, which is where I do all my business. Maybe just getting for the people who are listening, who are, say, musicians, and a lot of us are home studio based. Maybe just give us a kind of a rundown of your recording process today, as opposed to we just talked about what it was like back in the day. But maybe have a chat, just a little kind of chat about what you typically do to do your recordings today.
Well, I've got it's a very small room. It's basically a spare bedroom, which I use as a studio. It's also full of science fiction toys and memorabilia. So it's a small space because it's very, very cluttered. But I used to use a hardware-based system to record on a 24-track hardware, recording to a hard disk, but with a full-size mixing desk. But in recent years, I've reluctantly gone into the software route. So I use Cubase, and I use a controller for that, which is a little bit like a mixing desk in that it's got faders. And generally, I record every evening for a few hours. And I mean, the process is one of, I just go in there and I have no idea what I'm going to do, and I'll just start messing around with maybe some drum loops or a drum machine pattern or a sound from the keyboard.
Right.
And I'll lay stuff down to just see what that first couple of layers might sound like.
Right, it's very similar to, I know, that's exactly the process I use as well. Sometimes you just sit down in front of it. That there's so much in these apps these days that there's thousands and thousands of loops of this, that, and the other, and there's always something you just never got to.
Yeah.
And yeah. I find it's the music that we produce today is very much gone back to a cottage industry that, you know, it reminds me of the old, you know, old ladies creating sweaters in their basements back in the day. it's funny. The issue is, I find today, is that the process of recording and being creative is the easy part. Getting it out into the world, into people's ears, that's the hard part.
Well, to a degree, I mean, the internet sort of helps that along, but unfortunately, it also helps a lot of rather bad music to get out there as well.
Right.
Because anybody can put something up on YouTube or whatever,
right,
you know.
Right.
And there tends to be a lot of clutter.
Yes.
And people have to wade through all that to find the good stuff. And it's how do you find the good stuff? You know, where are the arbiters of taste, if you like? People like John Peel, who used to, you know, find really interesting music to play on the radio, and you would discover things. But you have to wade through such a lot of average stuff to find the special things. You know, it's difficult. It does help in, I mean, the internet helps in the way for me that I can release things from my own website direct to the fan, and there are no managers hanging over my shoulder or record company execs saying, can you do something more commercial, or, you know, we need to aim something at this market. I now have that total freedom to do anything I want. And so, you know, the music I make to entertain myself rather than to entertain anybody else. Luckily, that happens to hit some people in the right way, and they're supportive of what I do. But I don't really think about who I'm making the music for. It's just a process of getting something done that at least, you know, satisfies me as much as possible.
Creatively,
And it never does 100%, which is why you keep on, you know. Immediately I finish a piece of music, I start another one, because I think, well, that's not really good enough. I'm going to try something else, and I keep going. So it's that carrot of total satisfaction, you know, which is dangling in front of you, and you keep moving towards, and it keeps moving further away.
Did you ever get to that creative where you just actually caught, oh, this is just brilliant, I just love this, put it away and then come back to, oh, shit.
No, I rarely think, you know, that anything's brilliant. There are some albums that I feel I've got closer to what I wanted than others that I'm more proud of. But yeah, I mean, that's what you are. If you're an artist, you know, that sort of total satisfaction never arrives.
Yeah.
It always drives you forward to try and better the thing, last thing you made. So, yeah.
Oh, one thing I find with the recording process these days is that you go back and you listen to something that you never put out into the world 2 years ago, and you think, oh, I can do so much better that now than I did back then, because you're always in, I don't know about you, but I find like your skills are improving with the software, you're finding out there's new releases, that kind of thing. It's always an ongoing process, and it's not like a piece of art where you've painted it and it's done, it's up on the wall, or you can't go back. With music these days, you can go back and actually change the whatever, and it's always almost like a reverse process of creativity, that you go back and find something that you did and have a go again. One thing I did want to talk about is your fan base. Your fan base, because a lot of, I'm like, with me personally, with your music, I got into Bebop Deluxe,
I think around that 76 period, Ships in the Night came out. I heard that and then became a fan. Do you... you